and welcome to the Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast, where we talk with nurses working at the intersection of health and environment. My name is Beth Schenk. I'm a registered nurse from Missoula, Montana, and host of today's podcast. Today, our guest is Dr. Barb Polivka. Dr. Polivka is professor and Shirley B. Powers Endowed Chair at the University of Louisville School of Nursing, and we're thrilled to be able to talk with her today. Good morning, Barb. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this discussion.
Thank you. Well, tell me about your background in nursing and especially your interest in environmental health nursing.
Okay. Well, my interest in environmental health nursing really started with my dissertation. My mentor was an epidemiologist, a nurse epidemiologist, who was looking at environmental factors, influences in the prenatal period in children that develop cerebral palsy. And so I worked on that project with her and just became very interested in environmental health after that, and then continued in that area in my own research, where I began looking at the issue of lead poisoning prevention in Ohio, and did some work there with the state of Ohio and the city of Columbus when I was at The Ohio State University, where we looked at different types of educational interventions for healthcare providers, as well as screening rates in Medicaid populations. So multiple facets of that and the policy implications. So, and then I moved into the area of healthy homes because lead poisoning is just one area of potential exposure in homes, lead in pipes and in various areas. But I wanted to look a little broader at the home environment, and my focus for the past probably 10 years or so, maybe more, kind of lose track, has been in the area of home environmental exposures, with the idea that we spend most of our times in the home. And so what kind of exposures are impacting our health in the home? It's kind of a quick overall summary of what I do.
Wow, that's a whole lot. So let me just ask a little bit more about each of those. When you were studying the prenatal conditions that may have influenced cerebral palsy, what were some of the environmental factors related to that?
Actually, nothing came out significant in that study. It just piqued my interest, but none of the environmental factors that we looked at, the different kinds of exposures in the home as well as in the work environment. It was a case control retrospective chart review study, as well as I did interviews. Nothing came out significant. There were some things that may have influenced it. The only significant finding was that moms who had reported a UTI during their pregnancy had a higher risk of having a child with CP.
Interesting.
It was interesting and, you know, a little disappointing for my mentor. But on the other hand, I learned a great deal. And as I said, it really got me interested in the whole area of environmental health, just because nothing popped in that cohort that we looked at. Didn't mean that there wasn't anything there, or that other, you know, exposures may impact other kinds of prenatal issues. So,
yeah. Yeah, and that's how science works. We find out what's there, and so that was still a contribution.
Yeah.
So regarding first lead, and because you know, I don't know the years that you were doing that, and still are, but a couple of big.
Don't ask me to recall.
Oh, yeah. But a couple of big things really happened with lead in the past, I don't know, 30 years anyway, including the drop in rates of violence when the lead paint rules went into place. Is that, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we weren't really specifically looking at those kinds of issues. We were looking at more the screening rates, but those were clearly the impacts. And we were looking a little bit at the behavioral impact, and now the data are coming out pretty clear that there are some behavioral and other kinds of long-term effects of lead poisoning, even at low levels. I mean, I was very interested in the fact that we were, at that point in time, 10 micrograms per milliliter was the per deciliter rather, where the was the cut point that CDC indicated, and people were saying, if you know, healthcare providers, public health nurses, healthcare other physicians were saying that if your level was at 9, that was not going to impact you, and your child was healthy. Well, we now know that's not true. And so we were looking, and the other thing that was really intriguing to me and very disconcerting from a policy standpoint was all children who were Medicaid eligible were to be screened. That was actually the legislative impact. It was legislated that in Ohio those kids needed to be screened. And yet we found, you know, less, I can't remember the exact number, but very few were actually being screened. And when we looked into that with talking to providers, their response many times was, well, when I screen, nobody has any lead, you know, above 10 at that point in time, and therefore I don't bother screening. And so their thing was, well, if I don't find anybody right away, then I don't bother with anybody. And that makes no sense, you know, especially, you know, when it was Medicaid required and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the policy concerns from the state of Ohio were, you know, do we use a carrot or a stick approach? And they preferred the carrot approach. How do we influence them? What do we kind of reward do we give? And so they, you know, as opposed to, you know, what kind of stick, you don't get reimbursed. It doesn't, you know, it's kind of a, you know, so there was a lot of education in that area and what kind of education was needed and how do we get that information out at a, you know, an appropriate level and as widespread as possible. So we were looking at a lot of those kinds of issues.
Did it take you at all into considerations of infrastructure, you know, especially with the Flint, Michigan situation?
At that point, you know, Flint was, that was well before Flint that I was looking at these issues with the state of Ohio. The infrastructure issues were tremendous in the major urban areas such as Cleveland and inner city Columbus and Cincinnati and some of the other urban areas. But again, it was still an issue in the rural areas. So how we dealt with it, you know, there was that was at a point in time when the money for lead poisoning prevention was drying up. And people were saying, well, it's not a problem anymore. We're finding fewer and fewer kids. It was, I think the numbers were around 800,000 nationally at that point in time. And again, that was at the cut point of 10. So when we lowered it to 5, we were seeing more kids. And now there's discussion of lowering it even lower at American Public Health Association. Last year, there was several sessions on lowering it to about 2 or 3 and what that would mean. And so, you know, as someone who says any lead in somebody's system is just not supposed to be there and can have an impact, it's disconcerting to see this.
Well, that's super interesting. And then let's talk just a little bit more about your expanded work or additional issues and chemicals and exposures that you're looking at in the home. People, okay. You know, this has really picked up speed, I'd say, in the last decade in the popular media about not only exposures to chemicals, but air quality, water quality, et cetera. So tell me what you've been working on there.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to tell you the two areas that I've been funded to work on. One is a study that was funded by NIOSH, and we just literally ended in December of 2017. And this study started from my interest in expanding the knowledge base of students, and I'll sort of give you a little background here, students in understanding that individuals get discharged home, and when they get discharged home, they're exposed to various things. What happens in the home matters to their health. And so we were funded when I was at the Ohio State University, Dr. Rosemary Chaudhry and I were funded to develop a simulation, and we developed a real live simulation that would expose students to the various types of hazards that they might see. These were not only, you know, physical hazards, so we would have things like pests and chemicals, cleaning chemicals, and mold. In real-life simulation, we used what we normally use as clinical labs, and we converted them for a couple of weeks. And we had things like a stove that was pretty disgusting with food on it. And we had safety hazards such as a baby crib that was broken and with Venetian blinds that were half down. So these were safety hazards for the child. A lot of trip, slip, and lift hazards. So lots of things. And we would take the children through and have their students through, have various scenarios. And they would identify the hazards and then identify how they would help the family remediate these kinds of hazards, and just, you know, talk about what that might mean for somebody who might have been discharged from the hospital and then goes home to a place that has trip, slip, and lift hazards, such as even things like throw rugs, et cetera, and then they're back in the hospital with a broken hip. So, you know, thinking about this whole sort of life kind of perspective. And so that was very successful. Unfortunately, it wasn't sustainable because of the amount of time and effort it took. And so we then looked for funds to develop a virtual simulation that would address these kinds of things. So I have a team that I work with, and we have developed, and it's now available, actually just became available to download, a virtual simulation that addresses three major types of hazards, and it's aimed at home healthcare providers, because these are many times nurses, PT, OT, aides, who go into homes and are exposed to many kinds of things, and they're there on their own. They have limited actual control over what they're exposed to. So our simulation addresses the slip, trip, and lift type of hazards. It addresses fire and burn hazards, and it addresses environmental hazards such as pests and chemicals and mold and humidity and noise and barking dogs that can, are very protective of their owners. We identify these hazards by actually doing multiple focus groups with home healthcare providers and getting, we had, I think, this huge list we have published, I can't remember off the top of my head how many, but hundreds of hazards that they identify in the various rooms where they provided care. And what we learned from that was many times they really had very few options as how they might address these hazards to maintain their own safety and health. For example, they could walk into a home that had, and they could be in have asthma, and they could walk into a home where someone has just sprayed the home for pests and then end up in an exacerbation. And so we would talk to them about what that means. You know, our virtual simulation gets into why this is a hazard and what you can do about it, and what are some of the pest control measures they can advocate that would not harm their health. So we've got that developed and we've had that tested, and we found that it is effective as a learning method, and it's unique, it's different, it's a virtual training, so it can be implemented in many places, and we're hoping to get it implemented in schools of nursing and other healthcare professionals such as OT and PT that do go into homes, social workers, et cetera. So that's one on a whole facet of what I do. It's a lot of fun, and we're looking to expand it and make it actual virtual reality. We have that begun. We're working on that as well.
And are you working with engineers or computer technologists, or who
yes.
are you?
I'm working with human factors engineers. Uh-huh. We have two, and that's an amazing collaboration. We have a computer he runs the Ohio Supercomputer Center, and we work with his staff, and then we have the other members of the team are an OT, occupational therapist, who's also an epidemiologist, and another nurse scientist who's a decision scientist, because a lot of this is related to how people make decisions as to mm-hmm. what they do about the hazards they encounter in homes, whether they're their own hazards or ones that they encounter in their work situations.
And so is it, that sounds just awesome. And is it something that if someone were listening today, another faculty member elsewhere mm-hmm. who wanted to use this, how would they do that?
We just went live on a downloadable version, homehealthcaresafety.osu.edu.
Homehealthcaresafety.osu.edu. Terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for that contribution.
It is, we're excited to have people download it. It is free, paid for by our tax dollars to NIOSH, and available. And like I said, it's downloadable, and it includes an assessment module. So if students or anybody wants to take it, they can go through the three training modules and then do an assessment module to see what their retention is, how much they've learned.
Awesome.
So it is. It's a fun way to learn. We tested it with a lot of students and a lot of home care providers, and they really were very positive about it.
Great.
So, and that's one whole area. My other area of research is with asthma in older adults. I collaborated with a pulmonologist, and we are looking. This is a longitudinal study where we are looking at a couple of things. One are a lot of the biophysical measures and phenotyping asthma in older adults, because as we age, we are getting more and more older adults with asthma. And then we are also doing longitudinal assessments of their home environment, where we're assessing volatile organic compounds, particulates, moisture, humidity. We've just recently added carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and nitrous dioxide. So we're, as well as our physical observations. So we assess the homes 3 times at baseline. No, we actually, the homes are assessed twice, at baseline and at 18 months. We do pulmonary function, home spirometry, et cetera, at 9 months as well, and assess how they're doing. So we have about 100, almost 160 people enrolled to date. We're, like I said, following them and getting a lot of home environmental data to date.
That is super cool. And who's funding that one?
This is funded by the National Institute of Health, National Institute on Aging, and we're a 5-year study. We're just entering our 4th year, so we are still enrolling participants. We need about 30 more, but we anticipate we'll have that in the next few months. We are, like I said, we're getting a lot of data. We're finding with volatile organic compounds, we're finding, and we haven't really, we're still just beginning that analysis because we're still looking at all the data. We are finding, though, that VOCs are ubiquitous in people's homes. They are a number of VOCs. We have found about 15 VOCs, I think, that 95% of everybody have in their homes, and these would be you and I and everybody in here, and this is the greater Louisville area, and so yeah, it's interesting. We've seen some people with very high levels of things like benzene, and we look into it. We talk to them about what might be causing them. My favorite story of these is somebody had high levels, and we're asking, what they do, where they store things, and he told us they stored gasoline for their lawnmower in the basement. Well, though it was in appropriate cans, there are many reasons for not storing gas in one's home, and benzene is just one of those. Potential for fire is pretty darn dramatic. So that was moved, and we did see on reassessment that the levels went down of some of the VOCs. So
Are you looking at all at flame retardants in this study?
we're gathering, yes, we are looking at a number of, I mean, we gather information on 84 VOCs. So yeah, we are seeing high levels of the xylenes, benzene. We see a lot of high levels also of freons. Freons are not even, anywhere. They're not used anymore. They're banned, but they're still in people's homes. We see high levels of acrolein in people's homes, which we advocate people open their window or use their fans that actually vent to the outside. A lot of people's fans don't vent out. So that those, they can reduce those. One that has on initial, and again, I'm going to say this is initial analysis, chloroform, we're seeing those related to asthma symptoms. That was on our initial analysis. So we still need to see if that's going to pan out as we go forward. But those were related, as I said, to some asthma symptoms. So we talk about chloroform, and we have chlorine in our water, opening, and this is sort of the dilemma that individuals with asthma have, is opening the windows is great to air out your home and minimize somewhat the VOCs that might be there. But on the other hand, they have to be very careful when they open their home because of the pollen, et cetera, that many asthmatics will trigger their asthma. So, we do advocate looking at whether it's a low pollen day or a high pollen day. And if it's a very low pollen day, open your window. Those are things that we look at. So it's very interesting. And the different particulates, we do see some homes with very high particulates. Now, none of our subjects, none of our participants are smokers. That's one of our exclusion criteria. Some do have smokers in their home, so we talk about that and the particulates there. Some live near highways and other kinds of air. The other thing that we have uniquely in Louisville area is a number of distilleries. Remember, Kentucky is a bourbon brew place, and distilleries. From distilleries, there are a number of things that get them in the air, and a lot of it's a mold based. And so we've been in homes where they're near the distillery, and the mold, it's a unique kind of mold, is everywhere. And so my environmental scientist that works with us has actually worked to clean some of that, and that's been an interesting finding.
Yeah, I'll say. Wow, those are two great studies, and you are a real leader in research for environmental health nursing and nursing generally, and environmental health generally. I wanted to link it to your work for supporting research in ANI, the Alliance of Nurses for Healthy Environments. Tell us about what you do with the research work group.
Okay, so I co-chair the research work group with Dr. Jessica Kastner. And we've started this past, I think, about a year now, working to really bring in some, have some webinars with some other key researchers. We've had one of my colleagues who's doing some work with coal ash and its impact on children and neural development. We've had others looking at VOCs and looking at air quality. And so really trying to expose a lot of folks to different types of environmental health research. We're also beginning the process of really working to develop an environmental health nursing research priority list. What is it that we should be doing in nursing, and how, what are some of the priorities we might see for research? So we're working on that. So we meet once a month on Thursdays. I think it's the fourth Thursday of the month, and at 3 p.m. 3 p.m. I'm gonna have you
Awesome. And
edit.
those are open to anyone who's interested in attending. And that information is available on the environ.org website. So that would be great if people are interested.
Yes, we would welcome anyone. Yes.
So you have already more or less answered this question, but I want to ask it. So if you could articulate, why is environmental health a nursing issue?
Well, the environment impacts multiple aspects of our health. Although the work I did with cerebral palsy on preterm exposures didn't reveal anything specific, other people's work on environmental exposures in the prenatal period have revealed certain exposures have impact. So it's a lifelong kind of impact, and we need to understand what that complex group of it, how that complexity impacts our health, and more importantly, what we can do to prevent the negative impacts of environmental exposures. Yeah, I think that sort of summarizes it.
What are some of your ideas and recommendations for mitigating some of these impacts that you study or that you see?
Well, one of the things that actually in our asthma study that is not part of the study, but I feel very strongly about doing is when we identify these hazards, we provide the information to individuals about the health impacts of the various volatile organic compounds. When we find some in their home, we do tell them what we find. So we do a huge report back thing, and then we identify, you know, these are some strategies that you could use to mitigate them. So I think that's critical. I think the report back part of this is, as I said, it wasn't part of our initial study, but ethically, I feel very strongly about doing that, getting that information back to individuals so they can make decisions in their lives. And we've received a lot of kudos for that. You know, for example, we found that in somebody's home, there was a high amount of moisture and in their basement that was generating some mold. We provide incentive funds, you know, that folks get $150 gift card for use for doing the baseline data for us, and this person went out and bought themselves a dehumidifier with those funds. So that was a great, you know, that really kind of played very nicely. It's a good example. And then my study with home healthcare providers is, you know, what do we do? How do you recognize what could be a hazard for you? And then what do you do about it? And how do you work with the clients to make sure that that isn't, you know, that hazard doesn't impact their health as well as your own health? Because if it's impacting yours, it's impacting theirs or their families as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a you know, sort of a larger picture kind of a thing.
And has it led you to do any work with your local governments or state governments or federal governments in terms of advocacy and policy setting?
Sure. Yeah, I worked very closely in Ohio with the city, as I said, the city of Columbus and the state of Ohio in working, especially in the area of lead poisoning prevention and then further on in poison prevention, well, in healthy homes. I didn't mention my work in poison prevention. I've done a lot with the national, the Poison Control Center in Ohio to address poison exposures, which are primarily, you know, chemicals and medications that kids get to. So how do we impact that policy and education? A lot of my work has primarily been in education, but again, policy through the state of Ohio primarily.
So thinking about all of these areas you work on and others that are out there in terms of the environment and health, what is your biggest concern?
It's the lack of funding and recognition that we see from the federal government on down to the impact of environmental exposures on our health and not only the, you know, individual impact, but the long-term global impacts. That is very frightening to me. I'm very concerned about the fact that funds are drying up to address environmental health concerns, that they're being ignored, and that research dollars are disappearing to advance the science in this area. And without the science, then we're, you know, driving blindly.
Yeah, that's a concern, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And if you had a moment to just speak with nurses, which you do all the time as a professor and as an advocate and researcher, what would you say to nurses who are out in the field practicing? Maybe
is to be aware of your environment and to be aware of the environment that your patients are discharged to, exposed to, because that will impact their health and it impacts your own health. I think home health care providers and other nurses, public health nurses, are we're always very concerned about our patients, but we all have exposures that we could get into that we are exposed to that can impact our own health as well as our clients. Identify them, try to reduce and minimize those. In your own life, you know, things, little things like, are not so little, like we breathe in disinfectants and people have air, well, they're supposed to be air fresheners that they plug in. Those things are not, they're chemicals. So beware of that and beware of the impacts on people's health and try and minimize those exposures.
Terrific. Well, thanks so much, Barb. I've already taken too much of your time. Is there anything else you'd like to add today that we didn't touch on or that you'd like to emphasize?
Well, I think environmental health is an important area in nursing. We recently completed a scoping review of environmental health research that's been published in nursing journals, and we clearly see that this is an area that is important to nurse researchers and clinicians. So we know it's increasing over the past 20 years and will continue to. So So pleased about that, and hope that we, we have additional breakthroughs in the near future.
Terrific. Wow. Well, thank you as a professional colleague. Thank you for your contributions to all of this work. It's really important, and you've been just so lucid and clear about your studies, and I look forward to learning more from them.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And thank you all for listening today to the Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast. Check us out at Envirn, Envirn.org. And if you have a chance, please leave a review for us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks, and talk to you next time.